back we are with more broadcast excellence hosted by me, Rush Limbaugh, America's real anchorman and doctor of democracy, America's truth detector as well. As always, thrilled to have you with us. Telephone number is 800-282-2882. The email address, lrushbo@eibnet.us. So, let me go back here to the drive-by media, and they're flooding the zone today with news of the crisis at the border. And it happens to coincide with exactly what the Trump administration is saying. Customs and Border Patrol are saying we're at a breaking point. We have a massive disaster on our hands here. And the drive-by media is saying so. Now, in the New York Times case, they are attempting to acknowledge this while blaming it all on Trump. And the New York Times is urging the Senate not to support Trump's declaration of a national emergency despite this, because their objective is to make sure their readers and everybody else that might come across this understand that the only reason there's a crisis is because of Donald Trump. And however it adds up, well, the people around the world hate Donald Trump, but they love America. And if they get the idea that Trump's going to build a wall to shut him out, they're going to flood the zone before the wall gets built. Trump is responsible. New York Times, border at breaking point as more than 76,000 migrants cross in a month. So the New York Times has to admit there's a crisis at the border. Up until today, the Times and the drive-bys have been claiming that the number of border crossings is at a record low. So what's behind this? The New York Times is trying to say that it's all Trump's fault. Trump's new policies and his desire to build a wall are the reason for the surge, not the loopholes that were discovered under Obama, such as seeking asylum, such as coming from a country not contiguous. You wonder why all these people are coming from Guatemala, El Salvador, and so, because they're not if they're coming from Mexico, they can be automatically rejected. If they're not from Mexico, we're going to let them in. Loophole. Hence all these caravans. These loopholes that were discovered under Obama, widely publicized south of the border by the Obama administration. They were selling points. The Obama administration was telling people, hey, we've got a loophole in our law here that if you don't come from Mexico, if you originate anywhere but Mexico, we can't keep you out if you're seeking asylum. And all of this, we've got the ACLU involved in the creation of these loopholes, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. But it's fascinating. They're suggesting that Trump's policies have not discouraged new migration to the United States. 76,000 migrants, more than, crossed the border without authorization in February. It's an 11-year high. And a strong sign that stepped up prosecutions, new controls on asylum, and harsher detention policies have not reversed what remains a powerful lure for thousands of families fleeing violence and poverty. My friends, the courts have prevented Trump from implementing his new controls on asylum and harsher detention policies. The courts have stood smack dab in the way. They have not been implemented. Trump has tried, but the courts have stood the way, which is what the left does. Courts, liberals try to control the courts as much as they can for insurance against losing elections. Now, the Times says President Trump has used the escalating numbers to justify his plan to build a wall. Then the Times goes and gets a bunch of experts, but the wall will not be effective. First time in history, by the way, that a wall won't be effective. New York Times experts find, for the first time in the history of humanity, that a wall will not work in keeping people out. CNN gets in on the action. They quote the Customs and Border Patrol saying, system at breaking point, with more than 76,000 migrants illegally crossing or inadmissible last month. Wall Street Journal, more migrant families arrested at border in 5 months than in any previous full year. Now, folks, numbers are incredibly hard to follow on the radio. I know that, but I'm going to run through some of these anyway. Numbers are made for the printed page where you can go back and consult a number you just read to compare it against the number you're at present looking at. But just this little factoid, more migrant families arrested at our border in 5 months so far than in any previous full year. The United States has set a new record for the number of migrant families caught crossing its southern border over an entire year. It took just 5 months from the start of the federal fiscal year in October. Through February, the Border Patrol arrested 136,000 people traveling as families for crossing the border illegally. The prior record for a 12-month period was 107,000 during the fiscal year that ended last September. So 136,000 people traveling as families in 5 months versus 107,000 in the previous full fiscal year. Keep in mind that this number, family unit arrests, it's not the grand total of those arrested at the border. Notice that the number for fiscal year 2018, 107,000, is a full fiscal year. We already have surpassed that number at 136,000 arrests, family units, in just 5 months. And last year was a record year. We have beat a record year in 5 months. Since the Customs and Border Patrol began counting family units in 2013, there have been 2.6 million apprehensions along the U.S.-Mexican border. Now the kicker. Family units can be anywhere from 2 to 20 people. So think about what the total number of apprehensions there have been since 2013. It could be in the multi-millions. At the current pace, the number of families arrested at the border could double or even triple last year's record by just this September. So far, in the first 5 months of this fiscal year, 70 caravans of 100 migrants or more. There were only 13 caravans in all of last year and only two caravans in 2017. And a lot of other news sources have this same set of numbers, too. This is unsustainable. I mean, it's the word for it. Now, you might say, what happens when they're arrested? They're here, folks. We've got no place to detain them. We've run out of space. We've run out of medical treatment centers. We've run out of detainments. And we don't have the facilities to house this many people who have been arrested. All of this is by design. Catch, release, give them the date for their asylum hearing for which they don't show up. They vanish into the system. Democrats find a way to get many of them transplanted into existing families, sanctuary cities, and so forth, and the numbers just continue to multiply out of sight after the original numbers are tabulated via the arrests at the borders. Let me take a brief time out. We will continue with much more after this. Talent on loan from God. All right, heading back to the phones, Prescott, Arizona. Debbie, you're next. Great to have you. Hi.
Hi, Rush. This is Debbie. I have two comments for you. One of them you've already pretty much covered, and that's the Mueller report that's about to drop. I truly believe that no matter what that report says, that official impeachment proceedings will begin immediately, more or less. I just think that this whole special counsel operation has been more of a persecution than a truth-seeking operation. And I think Trump is just going to have to deal with an impeachment proceeding, which is so unfortunate. My second comment is on Michael Cohen. He is reappearing today before one of the House congressional committees. And one of the things I believe is that the reason for Cohen 2.0 is that his previous testimony failed to deliver a Trump knockout punch. So the Democrats needed time to tune him up and get his mind right. And so Cohen's reappearance today is for one purpose, and that's to drop something that can be coordinated with the Mueller report in support of impeachment. And did the Dems get a special counsel hint of what's coming? Probably.
I don't have any doubt about that. I think the statements and the efforts of Jerry Nadler indicate some form of coordination. In fact, CNN has just had a breathless breaking news report that Cohen showed this congressional committee he's testifying to behind closed doors edited statement documents from his last appearance, where, if I understand this correctly, he was said to have originally lied to Congress. And I think this appearance today is to take that off the table and to show that, well, no, he didn't lie. He was told to lie. And here are the edits and what I was going to say and what people like Trump didn't want me to say. So this is and he's attempting to show evidence or proof today that he was forced to lie. I think that's what's going on. So you may have a point there. But the impeachment, there's no question that impeachment is active. It's on the table and it is next up. And it actually, if you in your term, you want to look at the Mueller report as the first step of it. Yeah, I wouldn't dispute this. It's harassment. It is a pull no punches effort to, however long it takes, nullify the 2016 election results. I mean, even if Trump serves two terms, they want to be able to say that his two terms were nullified and irrelevant because of all of these various things over which he was impeached. I don't have, as long as the Democrats control the House, he's going to be impeached. You know, you realize impeachment is two things. Impeachment is just bringing in formal charges, and that's what the House does. Then those charges are then walked over to the Senate. The House appoints managers for each of the cases that they are charging impeachment on. There were 12 House managers for the impeachment of Bill Clinton, and part of this is payback for that. The Democrats still haven't gotten over that their guy Clinton was impeached. There's a little payback here. But they wouldn't even need that. They so despise Trump. They'll never come to grips with Trump beating Hillary. They're never going to be normal as such after that happens. So the number of cases that they charge Trump with impeachment, the number of high crimes and misdemeanors, that they'll all have to be walked across the Capitol to the Senate for a trial. And the assumption has always been that if the Republicans control the Senate, so you need 67 votes in the Senate for a conviction. That's 2/3. That's really a high threshold. That's a tough number to get. That's the number you need to override a presidential veto, which they don't have 67 votes. If Trump vetoes their refusal, if there is a Senate vote to not permit him to declare a national emergency, and he goes ahead and does it anyway, vetoes it, they have to come up with 67 votes to override his veto. They don't have 67 votes, at least right now, to override the veto. So they have to come up with 67 votes to convict on one or all or each of the articles of impeachment, they are called. So the idea that there's going to be an impeachment is a foregone conclusion when the Democrats won the House last November. The question is when. And there are two schools of thought on this. One school of thought is that the impeachment proceedings will commence immediately to become part of the presidential campaign to assist the Democrats in their effort to beat Trump in 2020. How can you vote for a guy who's under impeachment? My goodness, this man's a disgrace to the nation. He's already been impeached. How dare you? And then there's another school of thought, and it's a minority school of thought, but that thought is that the Democrats realize incumbent presidents are tough to beat, that Trump's going to win re-election anyway, and the impeachment will be for when his second term begins. That is what happened with Watergate, by the way. The original Watergate so-called crimes occurred late in the campaign of 1972. And Richard Nixon came along and beat McGovern in a 49-state landslide. So the Democrats began the Watergate hearings in early 1973, summer 73. That was the... I'm saying it was the... Well, it wasn't actually impeachment that ever got that far, but it's what the Watergate hearings were. And the way that worked out, for those of you that weren't alive then, or were and weren't paying attention, the hearings detailed all the news about the White House taping system and all the efforts that Nixon had engaged in to protect his people. They never produced evidence that Nixon knew anything about the original Watergate crime, and to this day, 9 out of 10 people can't tell you what that crime was. But the cover-up is what Woodward and Bernstein made their reputations on unraveling, and that was where Nixon was trying to protect his people, E. Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy and the plumbers and so forth. And as those hearings occurred, and more people testified, like John Dean, it eventually became obvious that President Nixon had lost support of his party. So they sent a big-time establishment Republican up to the White House to tell Nixon that it was over, that he had lost all support on Capitol Hill, including in his own party. That Republican was Howard Baker from Tennessee. True establishment icon. I mean, quintessential elitist Washington member, ruling class leader. They sent him up there, and they didn't have to go through with impeachment because Nixon resigned. Well, that is the lesser theory of two theories, that would be the strategery the Democrats would employ here. That it's too soon to the 2020 election, too close to actually conduct an impeachment proceeding and trial in the Senate and conviction. And the insurance policy for Trump winning re-election would be to impeach him after that. The problem with that theory is whoever Trump's vice president is would become president. It would not make the Democrats president. So the leading theory is that the impeachment proceedings that are planned will be immediate and an attempt to forestall Trump winning a second term in 2020. This is all it's speculation, but it's a lot of informed speculation based on the fact that nobody has any doubt that Democrats are going to impeach. And since impeachment, again, a reminder, is not really a criminal act, it's political. And you can't succeed with it. You can proceed with it anytime you want. If you're the Democrat, you want to impeach president. Anytime you want, you can give it a shot. But because it's political, The only way you have of succeeding is if you have first, and Nadler even mentioned this yesterday or Tuesday. Nadler mentioned, or Monday, I'm sorry, that they've got to convince Trump voters that they weren't trying to steal the, reverse the election results of 2016. They've got to convince Trump voters that they're really impeaching this guy because he's a bad guy, not because their noses are out of joint over 2016. If they're unable, that's why they cringe when they see Trump's approval at 46 in the NBC Wall Street Journal poll, because it's tough to impeach somebody at that level. Hi, welcome back. There's other news out there, folks, and let me continue on with some of that. whatever you want to talk about on the phones, feel free, have at it. But I do want to talk about some of the other things. Grab audio soundbite number 2 and 3. Thomas Sowell was interviewed by David Asman, who is at Fox News. He was filling in for Neil Cavuto. He's guest hosting Cavuto's show Coast to Coast on the Fox Business Network. And he asked him, he said, Dr. Sowell, you're a student. You were drawn towards socialist ideas when you were young. You wrote a book on Marx. What turned you against the Marxist socialist theory?
Facts. Before I was a Marxist, I was an empiricist, and I stayed an empiricist. And with the passing years, I simply, as I looked into more and more things, I saw the difference between reality and the rhetoric. Unfortunately, so many people today, including in the leading universities, don't pay much attention to evidence. When you see people starving in Venezuela and fleeing into neighboring countries and realize that this is a country that once had the world's largest oil reserves, you realize that they've ruined a very good prospect with ideas that sounded good but didn't turn out well.
Now, the next bite is the money bite. Asman says, I have to ask this question because you're so honest. And you see things so straight on. Do you think we're destined to go through a period of socialism where these ideas, which have never worked anywhere and will not work here, will still be tried? And if so, could this bring down our country?
I do have a great fear that in the long run, we may not make it. And I hate to say that. And the one thing that keeps me from being despairing is of course, we don't know. There's so many things we can't possibly know. And so we may make it, but I wouldn't bet on it.
Now, when I saw these sound bites, it reminded me, I've interviewed Dr. Sowell numerous times for the Limbaugh letter. He's a genuine national treasure. He is one of the few remaining scholars at the Hoover Institute who has not become Never Trump. Victor Davis Hanson is the other. But man, practically everybody out there has become a Never Trumper. These two guys are isolated. By the way, Victor Davis Hanson's book is now out, March 5th. Yesterday was the pub date. And it's The Case for Trump. I recommend books here all the time, but this one is so good. Victor Davis Hanson and The Case for Trump. He calls out the Never Trumpers by name. He just destroys them and makes mincemeat of them. And he explains to anybody who might care why Trump is Trump and why Trump is popular and how Trump won and why it is crucial that Trump continue winning. You know, Victor Davis Hanson and Sowell are not that far apart. They both think Trump is the last gasp at stanching this stampede toward socialism. Now, Dr. Sowell, he startled me. I very seldom am startled by what people say, but I was interviewing him once for the Limbaugh letter. It was back when Obama was president. And I asked him, what is your greatest fear as we are talking here today? And he said, my greatest fear is that the Iranians are going to set off a nuclear bomb somewhere and that Barack Obama would surrender. Remember, and I was caught short by the notion that he thought Obama would surrender. Not that the Iranians would use a nuke. I mean, that's not so far outside the bounds of, but that an American president would surrender. And I said, surrender? Whoa. I have no doubt Obama would surrender if that happened. If they take out Chicago, you damn well Obama's going to surrender. That's all it would take. They got an American city, and he'd give up. He'd cry uncle. And he was serious. He was dead serious. So when he fears that we're not going to be able to resist socialism, and he's doing this, says this on the basis that it seems to be forever popular amongst the youth, just no amount of evidence convinces these people that it can't be done. I have been trying to figure out why this is, just to satisfy my own curiosity. Because in my life, I have never once been tempted by it. I have, whenever I trace back my first intellectual awareness of such things. I have never been tempted by the notion of socialism. It's always repulsed me. Communism, socialism, all of these things. Now, a lot of it is the way we are raised, but I got to thinking, what are people's experiences with this that make them think that it is doable? Are there experiences people have at some stage of their lives that they think is socialism and it makes them feel happy or joyful or content? I said, is there such a circumstance in people's lives? And somebody said to me, well, have you ever thought about the structure of the nuclear family? I said, what do you mean? Well, you got mom, dad, 2.8 kids, you know, the drill. Okay, so what about it? Well, a person said, well, isn't the nuclear family, by definition, socialism? You've got the adults, the providers, you've got the kids, which are the objects here, and they're cared for, they are provided for, they are protected, they are shielded, they are loved and adored, and they are groomed, and they are prepared, and the world is all about them. And in their world, couldn't that be a little microcosm of socialism, the nuclear family? I said, well, yeah, except the nuclear family is deteriorating right in front of our eyes. We've been redefining the family in such ways that you and your dog can now be considered a family. Or you and your two wives. Or you and your tranny wife and your tranny husband can now be a family. So, I mean, the nuclear family is taboo these days. People that come from nuclear families are said to be privileged. He said, I don't care. It's still the first awareness people have of being taken care of being provided for with no responsibility. Oh, you might have the chores to do, but you don't have to earn anything. You have to earn a living. You don't have to do anything. You just have to get up. And especially in the modern era where the parents tell you how special you are and your self-esteem is the number one objective and you're never allowed to lose and you get a participation trophy for just showing up and you don't get any taste of what life is really like. So I stopped and considered it for a moment. Well, I guess it's possible, but I think there has to be more than that, and it has to be in education. Combined with the rebellious nature of young people to not accept what their parents believe in and so forth. So it's very complicated. But I'll tell you the one thing that has to be present for this dream of socialism to live, and that's full-fledged ignorance. Without ignorance, socialism doesn't have a life. Without people not being informed about what it really is, with people being lied to about how wonderful it is, how fair it is, how equitable, how equal, how sustainable, whatever the key words are, you cannot have people believing in socialism who are not abjectly ignorant. And that's what Dr. Sowell is saying here. Rhetoric versus, he says he's an empiricist, empirical data, the fact. Well, if you don't have the facts, if you're never taught the facts, if you are never taught the empirical data of truth, then you're left to wallow in the rhetoric. And the rhetoric can paint these vivid word pictures that create all of these wonderful illusions. And then you find these people who end up believing this stuff and they become the biggest hypocrites on the face of the earth. You know, the biggest hypocrite in the world is Al Gore. The biggest hypocrite in the world. Here's a guy who has arguably made his fortune promulgating a hoax and never subjecting himself to the rigors of a lifestyle that he would impose on everybody else. He travels around on private jets everywhere. He has a gigantic house, uses all kinds of fossil fuel to power his house and his other properties, his multiple jets and so forth. And there are people like that all over the left. Hypocrisy never, never attaches to them. They are exempt because of their good intentions. And they've mastered this game exceedingly well. I got to take a break. We'll be back and continue with you on the phones after this. Don't go away. Rush Limbaugh would have my brain tied behind my back just to make it fair and sustainable. Here at the EIB Network, here is Tim in Houston. It's great to have you, sir. I'm glad you waited. I appreciate your patience.
Thanks for taking my call, Rush.
Yes, sir.
Is Rand Paul and all of his running buddies over there naive enough to think that if they go against this declaration, that a Democratic president in the future wouldn't do it regardless of what he did? I mean, nothing, you know, gun control comes up, climate change, they're going to say this is so dire, this is so important, it precludes anything a Republican did, and they're just going to do it regardless.
Yeah, I think Senator Paul here is basically a man of principle. And on this, I think he sees a freebie. He can take a stand on this for his constituents and be on the right side of it and know that his vote's not going to affect anything.
Well, to believe that you're setting a precedent so the Democrat president won't do it is very naive thinking on my part.
Well, you know what I don't like about that thinking? And I know what you're talking about. Well, we can't do the nuclear option because what happens if the Democrats go? Well, ask Harry Reid about that. Harry Reid triggered the nuclear option, and guess what? It did come back to bite the Democrats in the rear end. They did it anyway. We've got to get rid. You know what we expect? Let me tell you exactly what we expect. This is the Never Trumpers. This is the rhinos. I think this has to do, in large part, not totally, but in large part, with upbringing. There is an element in American culture that says good behavior and proper manners and comportment will always redound to your benefit down the road. And so the theory is that if you demonstrate that you are honorable and of good manners, that you will be rewarded down the road by people who will recognize your decency and your goodness. Well, that may work in church, and it may work with certain elements, but it doesn't work in politics where you have nothing but vipers who are willing to take advantage of anything they see as weakness. And so the Never Trumpers have always believed that if we lose with honor, that eventually we will win because people will see that we are the ones with virtue. And that we will be supported, and our ideas will be supported in time because the voters will see that we are the ones with virtue. Well, the Never Trumpers magazines are closing down. The Never Trumpers websites have gone broke. The Never Trumpers are now forming new websites that will go broke. And all the while realizing or believing that they have virtue that will be rewarded somewhere down the road. The way it's looking, they may have to get to the pearly gates before that virtue is recognized. And many of them don't believe in the pearly gates, so they're really up between a rock and a hard place. And the way that manifests itself here, okay, we have a genuine crisis at the border. We have an illegal immigration crisis. And we have a political opposition that doesn't want to stop it. We have a president who does want to stop it, but we hate the president because he embarrasses us. So we're not going to help the president. And we hope somewhere down the road, the people that hate the president are going to reward us for being virtuous and also hating the president. And then we will somehow benefit. That's their thinking. It's a defensive way of thinking, and it's incorporated here. If we stand fast, you know, I'll tell you, the best way to illustrate how this manifests itself is Supreme Court picks. The Democrats, when they are in the presidency, they nominate these radical left-wing lunatics as judges. and look at the confirmation rates, 88, 92 votes, because the Republicans say, well, they won. The Constitution says the president gets his judges. We will be virtuous. We will show the American people that we are people of honor. We understand the president's party won and the president gets his judges. And they think that the American people are then going to reward them the next time their party is the president, that the Democrats are going to behave the same way when a Republican president nominates his judges, except it never happens, does it? Take your pick. Breyer, Kagan, Sotomayor, they skate through. They end up with 75 to 82 to 92 votes, and then you get Kavanaugh. And you see what happened with Kavanaugh. And then you get what they tried to do to Gorsuch. And then you see, well, they kind of took it easy on Gorsuch because there was nothing much to do. There wasn't changing the balance of power on the court. But you saw what they tried to do to Alito and so forth. It never works out. There is never a repayment for the virtue. So if Rand Paul thinks that standing firm against this use of executive power will somehow mean that the Democrats do not use that similar power the next time they're in the White House is just sophistry. The Democrats aren't going to care. The Democrats are not going to sit there, you know what? We better not declare this national emergency because remember when the Republicans joined us in opposing Trump? We owe them. It is just, it's a frustrating defensive posture and it relies on something that just doesn't exist. It used to. Folks, we have to be, it's part of what we've lost. There used to be these rewards for virtuous citizenship. Not anymore. Just doesn't exist. Not nearly enough. Back in just a second. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says the United States should not have authorized the use of force against the 9/11 perpetrators. Everything went wrong starting then. Man, oh man, oh man. Okay.